Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
You're listening to the Hazard Ground Podcast, with service members from across the military sharing their stories of combat and survival. And now, here's your host, Mark Zeno.
Welcome in once again to the Hazard Ground Podcast. As always, we appreciate you joining us each and every week. Before we get started with this week's episode, do us a favor. In fact, do yourself a favor. Get on iTunes, leave us a review and a rating, and make it a five-star rating. Why? Because if you're listening to this podcast, you really do like it, and we certainly do appreciate it. Also, want to remind you guys, follow us on all the social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, at Hazard Ground or at Hazard Ground Podcast. And then finally, make sure you go to our webpage, hazardground.com. And when you get there, click on that Amazon banner right in the middle of the homepage. Once you get to Amazon, do all of your normal Amazon shopping, whatever you need to buy, whether it's for work, for school, for business, whatever it is. Do your normal shopping. We get a percentage of what you guys spend, and then we donate it back to some of the great charities you've heard here on the Hazard Ground Podcast. In fact, your purchases through Amazon have led us to make our first donation back to one of the charities you've heard here, MVP, Merging Vets and Players. We're so proud of that and so thankful that you guys have been able to help out Merging Vets and Players and help us out along the way. So keep the Amazon shopping coming and make sure you're doing it through hazardground.com. Also, check out the rest of our sponsors on our webpage, hazardground.com. There's a tab there with the sponsors. Support them. You're supporting us. You're supporting vets. It's the best way to help out vets without ever having to leave your couch. Do all your shopping on our sponsors homepage right there. So again, Amazon banner in the middle of hazardground.com and our sponsors tab. And as always, we thank you guys so much for your support of the podcast. Now on to this week's episode. Very special guest joining us this week. He's a former U.S. Army sergeant, a member of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame, and a five-time Ultimate Fighting Championship title holder. He is also one of the co-founders of a veterans organization called Merging Vets and Players, where he is continuing to enrich and enhance the lives of veterans all across America. It is Randy Couture joining us here on the Hazard Ground Podcast. Randy, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Okay, so just an incredible story. Everybody knows who you are, and listeners of this podcast are probably so jacked to hear you tell your story. But we always like to start back at the beginning and how you got into the service and why.
My father and my uncle both served in the Navy. My sister and I chose to go in the Army. I was like everybody else, 18 years old, trying to find a way to get to college. Didn't really get any scholarship offers or anything like that. Sold my car, managed to walk on at Washington State. They were the only Division I wrestling program in the state of Washington at that time. Title IX had basically been decimating college programs across the country. Didn't make the varsity team, came home for Thanksgiving and saw the family, and it was about an 8-hour bus ride across the state. And about 3 weeks later, my girlfriend, for most of my senior year, calls me and says, "Hey, I'm pregnant." Showstopper.
Yeah.
So, finished out that semester, and then went and saw a recruiter, and took the ASVAB, scored well, and he said, "Well, you're pretty much qualified for whatever you want to do, but they're giving a $5,000 enlistment bonus if you want to go to air traffic control school." Reagan had just fired all those air traffic controllers in the civilian world, and all those military guys got out and took those civilian jobs, so they had a void in Army ATC, and $5,000 was a lot of money to me at that time, with a new kid on the way and recently gotten married, and so I joined the Army, signed up originally for 4 years, which then when I had to, 2 years in the reserves after, got in the middle of going to AIT and all that stuff. My first duty station was Hanau, West Germany, and stationed in a small caserne right in the heart of the Fulda Gap in the peak of the Cold War. So there was about, 5 million soldiers in Central Europe at that time. Huge sports programs. Obviously, we were concerned that the Russians were going to come across the border and invade Central Europe at that time, and that never happened. But I ended up wrestling, and they're back up on a wrestling mat, which I never expected. I kind of thought wrestling would was you know, a foregone conclusion with a new family on the way, but you know, things opened up, and I ended up winning the U.S. Army Europe Championship a couple times and got a chance to try out for the All-Army Wrestling Team.
Wow.
Which is, you know, by the time I left Germany after 3 years there, I had my second kid. My daughter was born there in Frankfurt. And ended up winning a couple of inter-service championships, which qualified me for the Olympics in the Olympic trials.
Wow.
Ended up being a soldier, you know, and in 1988, I ended up being an alternate on the 88 Olympic team as a soldier. So, you know, all these college coaches were like, well, who the hell was that kid? I've never seen him before. And the phone started ringing, and, you know, I had to decide whether I was going to stay the course and continue doing what I was doing as a soldier or get out and take a scholarship offer. And my coach encouraged me to really consider getting out, ETSing, and taking a scholarship. And he kind of pushed me towards Oklahoma State, as, you know, he had been in the Hall of Fame there and knew what an amazing program that was. I took that option, got out of the service in 88 and enrolled from Fort Campbell, Kentucky into Stillwater, Oklahoma for college. And at 25 years old.
That's unreal. So let's back up for a second, Randy. Hang on. So when you decided you were going to sign up, any objections from your family? I mean, was your girlfriend at the time with a baby on the way, was she all for it, or were there any concerns?
You know, I think she wasn't concerned. Obviously, there was no war going on at that time. You know, there wasn't anything going on. My dad was kind of against it, oddly enough. But I think he was more against the whole thing. He's like, you know, you don't have to marry this girl. You know, I don't know about your decision to, you know, to join the service. You have other options. My mom wanted me to stay in college, but I just didn't see how that was going to work. You know, without a huge amount of support from them, which, you know, they don't have, and then I'd already sold my car to go to college in the first place. So I just didn't see how that was going to work. How I was going to be able to support a family and stay in school. It just wasn't going to happen. So we, you know, being an ornery, stubborn, independent cuss that I was, this was the way I was going to get it done, and it just worked out. It would turn out to be the right decision for me.
Now, you obviously were an athletic person as a wrestler. Were you physically and mentally prepared for basic and NIT?
Yeah. I mean, they were, honestly, they weren't, I didn't find them that challenging. The PT test wasn't that big a deal. You know, everything compared to a wrestling practice, you know, paled in comparison, sure, to be honest. So, you know, the physicality, you know, that was, this is before combatives and
right,
a lot,
yeah,
of the things that the Army has now. I mean, we're still doing, you know, butt strokes and bayonets. So it was a different deal. And so I, you know, I didn't find it terribly challenging in the physical sense. So it was, you know, still lack of sleep and all the things that, you know, you're being programmed for. I felt very comfortable. I was one of those guys that everything in my room had its place. And so, you know, learning how to roll my socks and my underwear in a particular way and set all that stuff up was something that appealed to me and that appealed to the way I'm wired. So it worked well for me.
All right. So while you're on active duty, you're in Germany, give me the kind of the details of the transaction about the wrestling thing. I mean, it seems to come fairly out of the blue, correct?
Yeah, I roll into Fliegerhorst Kaserne. It was the 187th Air Traffic Control Company there. And, of course, they had the gym, you know, the base gym on the little Kaserne. So I was training, you know, walk across the street from the barracks to the gym. And was training over there, and this lieutenant said, hey, and this was before I had cauliflower ear, and this goes, hey, you wrestled? And it wasn't like I had the telltale ears at that time. I didn't get those till I tried out for the Army team. But I said, yeah, I wrestled in high school. He said, well, come on, you want to wrestle? And basically, he was the base wrestling coach, started taking me to German club team practices, and then every weekend he'd check out a van, and we'd all, you know, a bunch of us would pile in the van, and we'd go to a different base and wrestle in a tournament. ultimately ended up wrestling for the Fifth Corps Championship and ended up winning that, and then getting a chance to wrestle for the U.S. Army Europe Championship. And that's what ultimately got me noticed by Coach Floyd Winter, the All-Army coach. We ended up in the finals in both the freestyle and the Greco, and he gave me a shot to come back and try out, basically. It's a three-week trial process for the All-Army wrestling team, and basically you're sent TDY. We were sent to Fort Dix, New Jersey, which was a basic training post, and they put all the guys trying out for the All-Army wrestling team in a basic training facility in a quad, basically. And so you can imagine the shit that went on there, with a bunch of soldiers on TDY trying to make the All-Army wrestling team. So it was pretty fun.
It's funny you mentioned Fort Dix, not to date you or anything, but it was, as you said, it was a basic training post. Now it's like pushing thousands of soldiers, on deployment all year long. Fort Dix, it's bigger now than it's ever been before.
Yeah, it's a joint base.
Yeah, my last deployment was at Fort Dix, so it's a whole different world over there now. So let me ask you about wrestling and Army life. Were you okay with Army life? Did you have a tough transition? I'm just trying to find where wrestling, fit in with everything else, because obviously it takes you to the rest of your career. But was it one of those things where you needed something in your Army life to fill time, and thankfully this was there?
Well, I was trained as an air traffic controller and working in an air traffic control unit, both the tactical and fixed unit at the 187th Air Traffic Control Company at Fliegerhorst. So we had a fixed mission and a tactical mission. We had to kind of split duty. At that time, they were doing a lot of reforger exercises, again, practicing, playing war, basically. If the Russians come across, this is probably where they're coming, setting up LZs and doing all this stuff, setting up forward airfields for helicopters to combat the Russians if they should do that, basically playing war games. And that was my main job in the Army, but then I started becoming more successful, winning championships and moving up the ladder. I think ultimately making the All-Army team that first year in 1985, and then going to Pensacola for the Inter-Service Championship and winning a medal at Inter-Service Championships really kind of changed things. It kept me TDY for 6 months of the year, every year from then on, for the last 4 years of my enlistment.
How supportive was your command of that?
My command in Germany loved it. He was a West Point guy, and he just thought it was the greatest thing ever.
That's awesome.
And then I rolled in, I extended my enlistment for 2 more years, basically, to stay active duty and continue wrestling for the team. And I rolled into CONUS, PCS to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and moved into a different unit there. It was all tactical. There was no fixed base there. It was a complete tactical ATC unit. And the commander there wasn't having it. He was like, I don't give a shit what you did and how many medals you won. You were trained as an air traffic controller. We spent a lot of money to do that. By God, you're going to be an air traffic controller. And so Coach Winter had to go to DOD basically and get me reassigned to a different unit or lose me. I would have just stayed in. He wasn't going to release me TDY to continue to wrestle. And I'd already won a couple championships by that time and was ranked nationally. So he definitely wanted to keep me on the team. So he kind of had to pull some strings at DOD and get me reassigned to the garrison unit.
Now,
were
you the type of guy who was like, look, he's not going to let me do it. If he doesn't let me do it, it doesn't happen, and the chips will fall where they may? Or were you fighting for, hey, I want to keep wrestling?
Well, obviously, I wanted to keep wrestling. I was spending 6-8 months of the year away, TDY with the team, training wherever we were training. We trained that first year at Fort Dix, and then the next 2 years we were at West Point in their facilities. And then we got located at Fort Campbell, which was actually where I was stationed. So I would have been able to go to training camp every single day and sleep in my own bed and be with my family. So that was a great scenario for me for those last 2 years on the team. And my commander didn't want to let me go. And obviously coach wasn't going to take that laying down. He'd spend a lot of time, kind of getting me trained up and operating at that level. And so he got me reassigned, and I worked for the sports department basically in the garrison unit at 101st, and setting up intramural sports and engraving trophies and crap like that in between practices. So, it worked out.
Certainly did. You mentioned your family. How was your wife at the time and your kids being TDY for that long? I mean,
that was a challenge, especially when I was in Germany. So I would send them home to Seattle when I would leave TDY, usually in January. Army camp and trials were usually in January. So rather than leave them stranded for 6 months in Europe by themselves, I would put them on a plane and fly them home to Seattle, and they'd spend the time. You know, of course, our parents were happy to see the kids and happy to have them in the house and all of that. And then she would travel to some of the matches and come stay with me on base on occasion as well. So, but it was a challenge for sure.
All right. So let's go back to that decision point where you had to stay in or get out and go to college. You mentioned that your coach said, hey, I think you should take these offers. If your coach had said the opposite, do you think you would have done the opposite? If he would have said I think you should stay in, I don't really know if this is for you, you made a commitment, you know, kind of deal.
Yeah, I think I certainly could have been influenced that way. I was achieving my goals, working towards making that Olympic team, and honestly, he was a very important part of that. I think while I was in the service during those years on the Army wrestling team, I learned that I could compete on the international stage at the international level. I think I developed the competence to be able to go out there, and you know, it was from a small town and north of Seattle, it was a big step up. I think he could have influenced me that way, but I think his heart was in the right place, even though, you know, he was going to have to find a way to replace me in the lineup. There were a lot of other guys that were ready to wrestle there. So it worked out.
Before we get to Oklahoma State and where you wrestled there, best part about the Army wrestling team, what do you take away from that as the most?
Those friends, those guys that I sweated with and bled with every single day. And, you know, we traveled to all the national tournaments and the national camps, and, you know, those, that was family. Those were the guys that I spent an inordinate amount of time with. Living in Open Bay Barracks and training twice a day, iron sharpens iron. We were trying to make each other better and push each other to the max. And, you know, got my cauliflower ears from wrestling guys on that team. We beat the dog snot out of each other, and that was the way it was.
You still talk to some of them?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did they think back then you would end up being the Randy Couture they know today?
No, we laugh about it. I mean, they remember when I was riding a 10-speed to and from base, and to practice all the time, and driving a little Ford Escort. That was my hoopty ride back then. So they know the real me. They don't know who this natural character is that popped up in MMA.
That's pretty awesome. Okay, so let's get forward to Oklahoma State. You land there. Now, I mean, you have two kids at this time, and you're going to school on a wrestling scholarship. What are you doing to take care of them?
Well, I was fortunate. I had the GI Bill.
Right. Okay.
Which helped.
Yep. Yeah. Obviously.
And the college program and the college coaches loved that because that didn't count against their equivalency and their scholarships either. That was money they could spend on somebody else to get somebody else in the lineup as well. So that was a big plus for them. My wife worked on campus, and you know, we lived in a real small little house just off campus, and the kids, Ryan went to first grade there in Stillwater, started wrestling there for a little while while we were there through the YMCA. But the kids have fond memories of Stillwater, and it was really cool this June when I got inducted into the Hall of Fame there to take all of them back and kind of see campus, see how much has changed, and just be back in Stillwater. It was a really, really cool experience for the family.
Did it ever bother you being 25 and in college?
No, I never thought about it at all. And it was funny, my junior year, I'm going on 28, 29 years old, and wrestling one of the top schools, Penn State, and they have a really old gymnasium, and the bleachers come right down to the mats in this old gym. And I was 190-pounder wrestling in one of the later matches. This is before they started shuffling the weight classes like they do now. And I it was a close duel. We were the number one and number three ranked teams in the country at that time. So it was a packed house. And I took this kid down on the edge of the mat, and this guy in the third row yelled, "Hey, don't let that old man do that to you." And I looked up at him and I smiled, and they all started laughing. And then I commenced to really kicking the shit out of this poor kid from Penn State because of it. But it was a hilarious moment.
That's pretty funny. That's a great anecdote right there. Okay, so how does your college career end, and how do you know what's next? I know you mentioned the Olympic trials and everything else, but did you think while you were in college that was a realistic possibility still?
Absolutely, still wrestling on the national team. You know, really, you know, like I said, I think I developed the confidence to compete on the international stage at Oklahoma State. But I think I learned it at Oklahoma State was how to win and win at that level. I mean, I had training partners like Kenny Monday and you know, watching John Smith, who ultimately became my coach by the time I was a senior, you know, win Olympic medals, and the level of wrestling and wrestlers that were coming through that program and training around in and around that program was literally amazing. Some of the best wrestlers that we've ever produced and as a country. And so I was definitely in the right place to make the Olympic team and really kind of start winning on that international stage. You know, it didn't work out that way. You know, I ended up in the finals at the NCAA tournament twice, my junior and my senior year, and ended up losing in those matches. And, you know, obviously devastated to be in, you know, the biggest matches of my life at that point and not win. And then roll into the 92 and the 96 trials as the number one guy in my weight class in Greco, and had beaten world champions and Olympic medalists, and everyone expected me to make the team, especially those two teams. And again, managed to come up short in the final trial and not make the team. It was the alternate in the 92 and the 96 games. And so again, devastated, you know, wasn't sure, especially after 96. This is when I'd graduated and we'd moved to Oregon State, and I was coaching at Oregon State and wrestling, you know, for the national team still as the assistant coach there. And especially 96, you know, I just felt like that was my time. I'd really come into my own, and I think I'd won, you know, three national titles in Greco at that point and been the outstanding wrestler, Pan Am Games champ, a bunch of things. And so it felt like it was my time, and I managed to come up short. So then the question was, okay, now what? You know, am I going
right.
to continue and chase, you know, another quadrennium, another 4 years of training to try and make the team again, or what am I going to do? And one of my athletes in late in the summer in 96, we all kind of lived in the same apartment complex, a few of the older guys. And one of the guys brought this tape over, this VHS tape, and said, "Oh man, you got to check this out." And we watched this video of these guys fighting, and it happened to be an early UFC, and Don Fry was fighting on that video, and he was one of my teammates at Oklahoma State. So I was immediately intrigued. Here's this guy I knew really well fighting in this sport, in this cage, and I was like, what the hell, this is crazy, but really cool. And so later, you know, I met a friend who was a huge wrestling fan, and he's like, "Oh man, you should do that. You saw Coleman? Did you see Fry?" And I was like, "Yeah, I saw a video of that." And he said, "Man, you should try that." And I'm like, "I don't know about that." And he's like, "No, I know how to get the application, and I'll send it in for you, and you should give that a try." And so he did that. He went home and filled out an application and sent it in to the powers that be at the UFC at that time. And they came back like, "We want more exotic martial artists. You know, our champion's a wrestler already. You know, we don't want any more wrestlers right now. But we'll put you on our alternate list." And this was in December of 96. And then
that seems to be a running theme for you, unfortunately.
Yeah.
The alternate list. You know,
things work out the way they work out, right?
Right.
That next spring, I was getting ready to go represent the U.S. in Puerto Rico at the Pan Am Championships, and they called me up and they said, "Hey, we got a spot in this tournament in 3 weeks. You still want to fight? You're on our alternate list." And I'm like, "Well, I'm in shape. Yeah, I'll fight." So 3 weeks later, I was in my very first UFC, UFC 13, and kind of the rest is history from there. The head coach at Oregon State wasn't keen on the fighting. He thought it was bad for wrestling. He just thought it was, he thought it was crazy, frankly. And so he forced me basically to make a decision. Was I going to be a wrestling coach or was I going to be a fighter? And, it was kind of a no-brainer. They paid me more for that one fight than he paid me for the whole year.
That was going to be my question. What was the compensation like?
Yeah. So, although I was kind of angry that he was forcing me to make a decision, it was looking back, I'm glad he did that, honestly. Because I would have tried to juggle it all and as I had been going through college, on a scholarship and on one of the best wrestling teams in 4 years of college and still juggling, wife and two kids and all this other stuff, I would have tried to continue to juggle all that stuff, fighting and coaching and my family and all those other things. So him forcing me to kind of make a decision was the best thing for me, honestly.
All right. Let me ask you a couple of things here real quick. The guy you saw on the tape that wrestled with you, did you ever beat him in a wrestling match?
Actually, we had to wrestle each other. My freshman year was his senior year. He transferred from Arizona State. He couldn't make the team at Arizona State, and he didn't want to miss out on his last opportunity to go to the national tournament. And he had been wrestling heavyweight for us all year long. And then right before the conference championships, the Big Eight championships, they brought this freshman kid out a red shirt, and that kid took his spot at heavyweight, beat him in a wrestle off and took his spot. So now he was kind of pissed off that he was going to miss his senior opportunity at the national tournament. So he wasn't a big heavyweight. So he talked the coach into letting him challenge me, for my spot at 190. So we ended up having to wrestle off a week before the Big Eight championships, which isn't an optimum situation. I'm training and focused on going in there and qualifying my weight class for the nationals through the conference championship. And here I know I have to worry about my spot on the team. And though I kind of took it out on him, to be honest, it had to be a best of three series.
Mm-hmm.
But he had to win that first match to get the second match. And I kind of put the hammer down on him in that match.
Well, and the only reason I asked that is because I was wondering if you saw him do it, you're like, well, I can beat that guy. I can do this kind of thing. Was that like, a key to you that
it was
shot?
Intriguing. It's like, oh, man, I know this guy. I wrestled this guy. And, he was a great guy and he's a good friend. He was one of the only other guys on the team. Him and Chris Barnes were the only other two guys on the team that were married. And so we spent an inordinate amount of our free time together with our families. And so I knew him very, very well and was immediately intrigued by the sport, by what they were doing in the cage and how they were competing. And I just saw the direct application of years of wrestling training in the sport and just made sense.
Right. Now, let me ask you, there's wrestling, but then there's mixed martial arts. While you have a background in wrestling, that's not jiu-jitsu, it's not Muay Thai, and it's not, hand-to-hand combat. Like, you're not throwing punches in wrestling. So for you to step into the ring, were you worried that you didn't have any of these skills?
Well, it was a little bit different back then in the early days of the UFC. Guys were out to prove that they're martial arts style or their background was the best fighting style. That was Hoist Gracie. Hoist Gracie got prove the Brazilian jiu-jitsu was the best. Dan Severn, Don Fry, Mark Coleman were out to prove what wrestlers were all about and that wrestlers were the best combative sports athletes out there. And so I was on that bandwagon as well. I was like, yeah, here's what wrestlers are about. Here's the kind of conditioning and mental state that we bring to fighting. We have a very strong mindset, and I realized very quickly in that tournament that I had a whole bunch of other stuff to learn. I needed to really learn some form of striking and figure out what these jiu-jitsu guys were doing laying on their backs and catching guys in submission holds and choke holds and stuff. So I realized quickly I had a lot to learn and got about checking my ego and putting myself in those circumstances, in those situations where I was going to get punched and I was going to get tapped out. I saw that as the only way I was going to get better. I was going to learn those skills. And, you know, it didn't matter how many national championships you won in wrestling. If you didn't learn this other stuff, somebody was going to point that shit out to you in a hurry.
Yeah, that's a trial by fire, if you will. By the way, what did your wife and your family say when you wanted to do this?
They thought I was crazy. Yeah, my mom especially was concerned. You know, it was the one sport back in the day that she told me I couldn't do was boxing. It was the Linwood Elks Boxing Club. And I worked at the Elks Club as a busboy. And so I knew the boxing program was going on there. And I would sneak away and go to some of the boxing practices. And she found out about it. And she's like, you can play football. You can do whatever you want, but you are not boxing. And I'm like, okay. She kind of made me quit. So now we joke about it. She's like, I should have just let you box back then. You would have got it out of your system. But, you know, it's going to work out the way they work out. Yeah.
All right. So at this point in your career, like, just to kind of reflect back, the Army's far gone, but what from the Army do you still have with you at this point in time?
I have all those guys I trained with. I was still friends with all of them. One of my teammates moved up and became the new head coach for the program. They created the WCAP program, World Class Athletes Program for the Army service. And so they were recruiting out, you know, literally reaching out and recruiting a lot of athletes to come into the service and wrestle for the program as part of the WCAP program. So they, as far as Greco training partners, they still had a great group of guys. And, you know, the program at Oklahoma State was more of a freestyle program. John Smith, Kenny Monday, all those historic wrestlers that came through that program were all freestyle guys. They weren't Greco guys. There weren't many Greco guys around. So I still had a ton of friends that were in the Army that were still wrestling for the Army. And it was great for me to go back. You know, the first time I was at Fort Benning, Georgia, was going down and training with the guys. And even though I was in college, training with the all Army wrestling team and getting ready for the national tournament in Greco. So I still had a ton of friends there and was still, you know, very connected to all those guys.
You know, Randy, we joked about it before with the alternate thing, but, you know, you seem to have, I don't want to say, you seem to have come up short. I don't want to say you failed, because you certainly didn't fail, but you seem to have come up short, even going all the way back to your first attempt at college wrestling, you know, the national team and everything else. Was any of that fuel for the fire to say, now I'm going to go be a UFC champion?
You know, I entered that first fight literally on a whim. You know, didn't expect them to call. Like I said, my friend turned in the application for me and they put me on an alternate list. So it was a surprise when they called and asked me if I wanted to fight. And I literally did it on a whim, on 3 weeks notice on a whim. And obviously it went well. I ended up winning the heavyweight tournament. I fought twice that night. And then, of course, they said, hey, we want you to fight in the super fight, you know, in 3 months in October. And so now I'm going back to the head coach, who's already kind of irritated that I've done this, and, you know, saying, hey, I need to take some time off. I need to find a boxing coach, because this kid they want me to fight next is a great boxer. He's tearing people up. If I don't train in some boxing, I'm going to get my head knocked off. And that was when, you know, the coach kind of said, well, all right, well, that's great, but we got our athletes coming back into town. What are you going to do? Are you going to be a boxing coach or a boxing fighter or a wrestling coach? And kind of forced me to make a decision. And I spent about 3 weeks down at Hermosa Beach Boxing Works training with Tony and Scott and the guys there to get up to speed on facing a southpaw like Vitor Belfort in my second UFC and dealing with this, you know, young, phenomenal Brazilian black belt who is literally – punching everybody's lights out in under 2 minutes. Spent a bunch of time boxing every single day and trying to figure out footwork and how to punch and be punched and all these things I'd never done before. It was an interesting process for sure.
So in that fight, I mean, you end up defeating Vitor Belfort in that fight. Did you feel like going into it, you were ready for it?
I did. I was just coming off of the world championships in wrestling in Greco. And that was in 97. That was the highest I had placed at the Worlds. I placed ninth in that World Championship in Greco. So I was in great shape, great wrestling shape. As I said, I'd spent a few weeks in California training in boxing and kind of getting up to speed in boxing. My trainer and manager at the time was Rico Ciparelli, and Rico just had this, I don't know, he had a very uncommon knowledge of how wrestling fit together in fighting situations. He was a brilliant guy, very, very good wrestler himself, wrestled at Iowa and was a national champion in Iowa. And so guys like me and Henderson and Linlin, he was our first kind of entrance into mixed martial arts, and kind of took that same mentality of wrestling where we studied our opponents and looked at footage and tried to figure out a game plan to go out and put ourselves in the best position to win, was all about how he operated. So it fit great. He's like, look at this guy. He said, look what he's doing. He starts every combination with his left hand first. He's very straightforward. Nobody's using any lateral movement. That's how he's catching all these guys. If you use some lateral movement, circle away from his left hand and find a way to close the distance and get your hands on this guy, if you make this guy wrestle you, he can't stay with it. There's no way. I've watched him. We watched him progress. We watched, his last four fights. And he just said, if you make this guy wrestle, he's gonna blow up. He's gonna get tired, and there's no way he can stay with you. And that's exactly how it turned out. I mean, to the letter. So I, told my mom, this is the game plan. This is what we're gonna do. And so then she starts scratching her head after she sees that unfold and realizes, well, maybe I'm not crazy. Maybe there's more to this than she originally thought. So.
You're, I guess it's technically your fourth professional fight, but I mean, you're against Maurice Smith. You win your first title belt there, correct?
Yeah.
What was that like?
The super fight put me in for a shot at the heavyweight championship, and the winner of that Vitor fight was going to get that shot. And I, never been to Japan, and, it was, a whole different animal. So here I am, got in this on a whim. 3 months ago, and now they're saying, oh, yeah, you're going to fight for the world championship in 4 months. And I'm like, holy crap, what just happened? And now I'm going, flying to Tokyo in December. We fought in Yokohama and spent a week over there kind of getting acclimated to the time change and figuring out what it was all about and studied footage of Mo Smith, watched him, beat up Mark Coleman and take Mark's title and really kind of had an idea what to expect. Here's a guy that had, 17 years kickboxing experience, wasn't a wrestler or had a wrestling background, but he'd been working a lot with Frank Shamrock and they've been trading information. Frank was teaching him about ground skills and how to survive on the ground. And he was teaching Frank how to kickbox and use Mo's expertise as a kickboxer. So I felt like this guy was going to try to kick me, and I just trained every time that he picked his foot up, I was going to take him down. And back then, obviously, it was different. It wasn't 5-minute rounds like it is now.
Right.
It was a 15-minute go, and then if there was no winner determined after the 15 minutes, then you did two overtime periods of 3 minutes each for a total of 21 minutes.
That's unreal.
Yeah. we went the entire distance, but every time he tried to kick me, I followed through with a single or a double and put him on his back, and then managed to keep him there the entire fight. Probably wasn't the most exciting fight, but mm-hmm. The Japanese crowd, they're very in tune with the tactics and the technique. A little less about the sensation. The American fans probably would have been booing and trying to get more of a brawl instigated. That's kind of the style the Americans fan like. But the Japanese, they like the tactical, technical fights.
Sure.
And they seem to be totally into it. There was 19 or 20,000 people in that arena, and there were times when you could hear a pin drop in that place. It was amazing. You could certainly hear my wife at the time screaming over the entire crowd, which was hilarious.
It's kind of funny. So you get the belt. You get to put that belt around your waist. After all the other times coming up short, what's that feeling like?
It was overwhelming. And again, you start to think about the journey that you've been on and the time, the setbacks and the times you failed or and didn't achieve what you'd set out to achieve. And then here I am, you know, using all those same lessons and all that stuff that I, you know, waded through and managed to survive, and applied them here and was successful. So it was overwhelming for sure.
I'm not going to chronicle your entire fight career, just take way too long, but you actually lose your first fight in the next fight you have. And so quickly the belt goes away. And I mean, you know, then you, when you start to get into this fight after fight,
I took a little hiatus. They wanted me to fight Coleman, which I was okay with. And I knew, you know, with all the cross training I'd been doing, I knew the first time I ran into another wrestler, it was going to be a much more challenging fight. I wasn't going to be able to rely solely on my wrestling background to put me in positions to win. And I had a bit of a contract rhubarb with Bob Meyerowitz and the guys that owned the company back then. And so I took a break. They basically said, well, we want you to fight Coleman, but you know, we can't pay you what we're supposed to pay you, what this contract says. We just can't afford to do that. And I'm like, well, I'm ready to fight, but you know, we got a contract. We spent hours and hours negotiating this contract. Why would we not honor that? And so they said, well, you choose not to defend your title, then we're going to strip you. And, you know, and that's what started the heavyweight tournament, that Boss Rutan ended up fighting in and winning. But he fought Kevin Randleman in that. Coleman actually left and went to Japan and started fighting in Pride that time. And I took about a little over a year off and tried to make the 2000 the Sydney Games, the team for the Olympics in 2000.
Why did you keep going back to the Olympics? What was it, just about the America thing, representing your country, or was there just a drive to be on that team?
Yeah, it was just a goal that I had set that I hadn't accomplished, and you know, I realized in 96, the chances of going another 4 years and making the team, probably, you know, that window was closing. But here I was fighting, which was a surprise, making decent money, supporting the family, which freed me up from my coaching duties. I could train full time, basically. So if I wasn't training for a wrestling tournament and, you know, represent the U.S. or going to the nationals, then I was training for a fight. It allowed me to be a professional athlete and train year round and not have to worry about supporting the family and the funds and all that stuff. So it was actually a good deal. And I was still winning on the wrestling mat. So, you know, in 99, I won another national title in Greco and you know, was again, I wasn't probably the favorite, but I was still one of the top guys in my weight and going into the 2000 trials.
I mean, throughout your career, your MMA career, you had numerous battles against Vitor Belfort. You fought Chuck Liddell plenty of times, you know, Brock Lesnar, some of the biggest names in the sport. You know, when you win or you lose in that professional world, is it any different than when you were an amateur?
No, I don't think it is any different. I think your spirit, your passion for the sport is what drives you and what, you know, forces you to make the sacrifices you need to make, whether you're getting paid or you're just doing it because it's what you love to do. Either way, that's what it's about. And so winning or losing still feels the same, regardless. It's never about the paycheck. And I try to talk to fighters about that. If you're doing this just because you want to get a paycheck, then this is a tough way to make a living. You are probably in this for the wrong reasons.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, and again, I think those losses, those setbacks, were important in my development, both as a human and as an athlete. And, they set me up for the volatility that I signed up for when I started fighting. It's a very up and down sport. It takes one mistake, you know, and talk about, you know, my record is, you know, 19-11. It means, I've certainly lost my share of fights. And, everybody is like, oh my gosh, you won 6 world championships. I'm like, yeah, that means I lost it at least 5 times, asshole. What do you think?
That is a fact that you can say. It just again, I don't mean to laugh, but when you put it that way, yes, there is.
I don't think you measure a person's character by how they are when they win all the time.
Sure, no,
the true measure of their character is how they deal with adversity. And I, certainly have had my share of adversity, both as a kid and then, on the wrestling mat. And those adversities prepared me well for what fighting was.
You mentioned last year, obviously, you were honored by the Wrestling Hall of Fame, inducted last year in 2018. When that happened, when you get that phone call that, hey, Randy Couture, we want to put you in the Wrestling Hall of Fame, that validation, is that, just, oh, my God, I can't believe this is happening? Give me kind of the range of emotions you're feeling.
Well, certainly a huge honor. And they do a little video vignette of each of the honorees for that year's class. And so they came to the house in Vegas and talked to me about, my journey. And I was inducted as an outstanding American, which is a huge honor. Obviously, they're recognizing me for all the other stuff that I've been doing outside of the cage or off the mat.
We're going to get to that in a minute. Just, don't go too far down the road.
And so that was, obviously a huge honor, but I had to be honest. I said, in my video vignette, I'm like, I would have loved to have been put up on these walls in the Hall of Fame for wrestling, for winning, a world championship or winning an Olympic gold medal. I mean, that's what I set out to do, but it's still a huge honor for me to be recognized for what you guys are recognizing me for as an outstanding American. So if there's if there's another way to get there, that's probably the way you want to get there. But originally, sure.
Well, look, you have a number of gyms, right? Fitness gyms, a clothing line, and you are spending time helping veterans. You also teamed up with Jay Glazer, who is an NFL reporter for Fox Sports, and former Green Beret and Hazard Ground podcast guest Nate Boyer, and you created Merging Vets and Players, MVP. Now, I have the fortunate pleasure of being part of the Atlanta chapter here. That's how you and I met, is we just launched, a couple of months ago back in December of 2018. That said, I love what you guys have created. I love the environment and the family and the culture that MVP is about. But why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got linked up with Jay Glazer and Nate and where you guys came up with this idea?
Well, Jay and I have been friends for quite a long time. I think going into the second Chuck Liddell fight right after the Ultimate Fighter, he's good friends with Chuck Liddell as well.
And
I met him on the mats training in Vegas. I don't remember what he was in town for, but he came by the Ultimate Fighter Training Center. We were in between shows, so we were in there training, and I hadn't fought Chuck for that second show yet, that second fight yet. So I met him there, trained with him there. We hit it off. He's a gregarious, personality and just a great guy. And one of those guys that, he's just fun to be around. And I think that he brings an integrity to what he does, which is why he's come as far as he has with being an NFL insider and all the stuff that he does. He's just one of those guys. So we hit it off immediately. And then down the road, we started training pro ball players using MMA as a cross training tool. We called it MMA Athletics. And obviously I had a great facility. We opened the gym in Vegas. It's a big box gym, 24,000 square feet. So we were trying to bring those guys into Vegas and train them in Vegas. And that was a bit of a problem for some of them, keeping them on task and out of casinos and stuff in Vegas was a challenge. So we ended up training more guys in LA, and ultimately we were using some other guys' gym, and Urlacher and Jay kind of decided they wanted to open their own space, and that's when Unbreakable kind of came on board. And it was through that process of training ball players that we recognized, and then especially through getting to know Nate Boyer, we recognized when you strip these uniforms away, whether it's the camouflage uniform or the shoulder pads and padded football pants, that transition is very difficult for a lot of guys. And it was through discussions with Nate and Jay that they realized that they could bring the two groups together because there's a mutual respect between them, and they can lean on each other and learn from each other and share and kind of get reconnected, get that locker room back, get that infrastructure back that's been kind of taken away when you strip away those uniforms. And that's kind of how MVP grew. And we had the Unbreakable MVP program going really well. We started with like 8 guys. I think all of them were homeless. And within a matter of months, guys, slowly through this camaraderie and helping each other, started coming around. We ended up, getting 20, 30 guys a workout, and then the huddles, the chats that we'd have after were just really moving. Guys would feel comfortable enough after sweating together to share the things they were struggling with, and created this place where guys can come and kind of be themselves and get reconnected with people that speak the same language and struggle with the same issues in that transition. And it just became a really, really powerful thing. And I kind of got tired of saying, when are we going to open another one? Come on. We need another branch. And being the gym owner in Vegas, I just kind of took the ball or the bull by the horns, if you will. And SHOT Show was coming up, which is a huge law enforcement and military convention in Vegas. And I said, let's open MVP at my gym. I'll give the space and the time. And, I realize we don't have any funds for any of it, but I don't care. Let's do it. And we just kind of ran with it. So that was a huge success. I think, Nate showed up. We had like 60 guys show up at that first workout. Obviously, a lot of those guys weren't indigenous to Vegas. We ended up with about 20, and now we've grown that to about 40 in the Vegas branch. But it feels like family. We speak a particular language. The average civilian running around hasn't been through the training, hasn't seen it, done the things a lot of us have done. So it's hard for them to understand. They understand when all that's stripped away, what that struggle's like. We're not normal humans, both as professional athletes or as soldiers. We're a very, very small percentage of the population that's operated at that level, and that makes us special. A change in that narrative. Everybody wants to tell you you're broken. There's something wrong with you. They don't recognize that there's nothing wrong. We're special. We're unique people on this planet. So getting that narrative kind of driven home, getting these guys thinking differently, getting them reconnected to people that understand, that speak that, has been really powerful.
It has. Look, and a personal story. The night you came here to open up the Atlanta location, after that night was over, and I've told the story a bunch of times after on our Matt chats, but that MVP shirt that I got that night that we all worked out and poured sweat in and everything else, when I got home, I didn't want to take the shirt off. And the reason I slept in it. It was dirty and disgusting, and I slept in it. And I say that because I felt like taking that shirt off would have removed the connection that I felt in that room. And I wanted to hang on to that, And so from that day on, MVP for me has become a big staple of who I am and what I do each week. It's part of the fabric and the culture of my life because, this. We say this all the time when we talk about veterans. I show up because it makes me feel good, but somebody else in that room may need me without me knowing it, without me having any idea. Somebody in that room may find inspiration in something that I do, and I owe it to my buddies there and the other males and females who show up every week, because that's really kind of what we were longing for, that connection, that brotherhood that we had when we had our uniform on. Now we have a place that we have it back.
Yeah, I mean, that's awesome. I love that. That's a great perspective, and I couldn't agree more. What was really amazing about that night in Atlanta was the one ball player that really opened up and kind of laid out his struggle in transition. And as much as we've had more trouble kind of breaking through to the ball players,
sure,
than we have our guys in combat fatigue. So, they seem to be a little more comfortable expressing their vulnerabilities and the things they're struggling with. They haven't been put on this pedestal as much as these ball players have. And so getting those guys to admit, that they're struggling in transition has been a much bigger challenge. So I was really, really pleasantly surprised by the ball player that came that night and really opened up. And that was kind of the first time we've had a ball player like that, do that. And so I just thought it was a really big step for us as a group. And it was just a great night. It was a ton of fun.
Also, outside of MVP, you're spending a lot of other time with veterans, visiting military bases and seeing them. Is that something that you want to continue to do and that you really see value in and always will continue to do?
Absolutely. We were just in Fort Eustis, Virginia, at the joint base there, both on the Air Force and the Army side, for 4 days in December. It's kind of a morale, you know, right before the holidays. A lot of trainees there, but it was a fight night. And me and the guys from MMA Junkie Radio, they've been doing this for about 12 years now. They asked me a couple years ago to come, and I couldn't fit it in my schedule. So this year it fit, and I got to go. And I mean, just had a blast. That energy is so infectious, so positive. You feel like you're those guys are sitting there in that uniform going through the training. And I remember being in that spot. And so for me to be able to give back to those guys and let them show, you know, let them see that there's life after that choice that they made, that you know, life goes on and they're in a great place, and how that decision affected me and the rest of my life. I think that's a positive thing. And so, I feel good about going and rubbing elbows with those guys.
Listen, it makes me smile, man. I mean, honestly, it does. It's great to know that part of your life, you know, the military connection to it has never left you. And, you know, it's easy to put it in the rearview mirror, especially when you've had success in other areas and not go back. But the fact that you still do, I think, is a testament to your character and kind of how much you recognize what the military did for you in your life and why it's still important. So from, you know, one soldier to another, I certainly thank you for that. Let me hit you with a couple of quick ones here before we let you go. And most of this is about the fighting stuff, but let's just have a little fun here.
Okay.
Do you remember your worst defeat, whether it's in college or professionally?
Well, I remember going to an open tournament. This is when I was, you know, 18, walked on at Washington State University, went to an open tournament somewhere in the state of Washington with the team and just got my ass handed to me by a senior in this open tournament. And I mean, I couldn't score on this guy, and he was just playing with me. And I remember being so frustrated, it was just so outclassed at that stage of my wrestling career, but it was a valuable lesson. And obviously, I feel like embracing those losses. I talked about a 19-11 record and, you know, yeah, six championships, but that means I've lost it at least five times. And those losses were way more important than anything else I experienced. You know, I never went and watched the tapes of the fights I won. What the hell? Why? But I guarantee I watched everyone I lost multiple times, right, trying to figure out what my mistakes were and how I could have changed that outcome. And that made me a better athlete and ultimately, I think, a better man. So I think facing that adversity, dealing with those losses, picking myself back up, recognizing that the sun was coming up that next day and the people that really mattered don't care. And the ones that care, guess what? They don't really matter.
Right.
So that was a huge transition for me. I think the thing I recognized first moving from wrestling to fighting was that I was overtrained in wrestling. I was that star pupil that coach was going to highlight in the sprints or, you know, was kind of that example of work ethic. And I think that's something I got from being in the Army and having to wrestle my way up to even make the All-Army team. And it kind of, in some ways, became a hindrance because I was continually overtraining and overdoing it and not learning to taper and listen to my body. And it wasn't until I started transitioning to fighting and having to fight for 25 minutes, you know, it was a lot different than a 6-minute wrestling match. And tempering that wrestler's mentality and learning to take care of that body so it had the endurance to go 25 minutes as hard as I needed to was a very learning thing for me. And I realized I was overtrained in wrestling.
Who was the guy who hit you the hardest?
Well, I've only been knocked out, really knocked out once, and that was the second Chuck fight. I took a big swing in the left hook and missed and put myself right in position, and he drilled me with a straight right hand. And that was the first time I ever lost that little piece of time. One second I was there, and the next second I was looking up with a bunch of faces over me going, what the hell just happened? And so it was a strange experience to lose that little piece of time. I've been flashed before, even in the third Chuck fight, but he didn't knock me out. You know, the Brock fight, that was a flash. You know, the Machida fight, got kicked in the mouth. And you know, it's one of those deals where you get hit, and then as soon as your butt touches the canvas, it like snaps you back to, you're not really out. You don't really lose consciousness. It's that split second flash of, oh crap, what happened? And but the only time I was actually really knocked out was that second Chuck fight.
Ever cry after a loss?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. It's an emotional thing. You put so much time and energy into that performance. In the 96 trials, after the final, you know, coming up short in the final trial and not making the team, I was devastated. It was tough. And you're there with your coach and you know, your loved ones, and it sucks. It's tough to, you know, but same thing, you know, the retirement fight. I retired after the third Chuck fight. And that was an emotional thing too. I was going through a divorce. It was dragging on. It dragged on for a couple of years. I just felt like I wasn't myself. You know, in the training environment anywhere, I just felt like I wasn't myself. And so after I lost that fight and again, pretty devastated, but just felt like I needed to step away and kind of reset. And I wasn't sure if that was going to be it, if it whatever, you know, I was in my 40s. So it wasn't like I was a sure. spring chicken.
Yeah.
I think it was 42 at the time. But it just felt right. I needed a break, and I wasn't getting the job done, obviously. And about 13 months later, I started grappling, and the dust settled, the divorce finally settled, and I just started feeling like myself again, and feel like I had more to do. And then the opportunity to come back and fight Tim Sylvia came along, and I was off and running after a 13-month break.
Yeah, and then finally, victory that meant the most to you.
I think that victory against Tim Sylvia, obviously the first one was such a whirlwind. You know, in 6 months' time, I had my first four fights and won a world championship. It was like, what just happened? It was crazy that it just, I mean, unfolded that way. It wasn't like I even had time to set goals and work for that. I just found myself in this circumstance and on a whim and managed to come through. And then, like I said, when I took that time off to pursue the 2000 games and was kind of in at odds with the owners, they asked me to come back in the fall of 2000 and fight Kevin Randleman for the title. And again, I knew as soon as I faced another wrestler, it was going to be a much different fight, a much tougher fight. And the question was, who's going to take who down first and put him in that position of disadvantage? And Kevin took me down in the first two rounds, and I spent those rounds on my back finding a way to survive. And thankfully, I had spent enough time trying to learn and be effective there. And then I took him down in the third round, and that was the difference. He hadn't spent any time working on his, you know, on his back, and he didn't get back up. So I was back as the heavyweight champion after over a year off. But that Tim Sylvia fight, you know, coming back at 44, fighting him, who's, you know, 6'8", we look like Mutt and Jeff in the cage.
I could tell which one you were.
Yeah, right? And then just that crowd, that was the biggest crowd in North America at that time, and they chanted I mean, that's just, that whole night was just amazing. And again, one of those times where I don't think anybody gave me a snowball's chance in hell winning that fight. And it went well. It went exactly how I hoped it would go.
Well, on that note, Randy, it's just an honor to thank you so much for spending some time with us. And listen, continued success and continued growth for Emerging Vets and Players, MVP. It's a fantastic organization. If you guys want to help out, you can go to vetsandplayers.org and donate there. You can help start up another chapter in your city, whatever it may be. But certainly it's a fantastic veterans organization and one that the Hazard Ground is very, very close to. But you know, again, thank you for your candor and your honesty. I could chat with you for another hour easily, but obviously you have things to do and a very busy individual. But I certainly appreciate your time and certainly appreciate you be willing to sit with us and give us your story.
Thank you, man. I appreciate you having me on. And, anything we could do to continue to connect guys that have taken that oath and worn that uniform, I think it's important. And we're going to keep knocking it out and spread this thing. And it's been great to have the NFL behind us and the Bellator behind us, helping us fund some of these pop-ups and get some of these new branches up and running. So it's been really, really cool. And it was a pleasure to meet you. And again, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Randy Gatora, thanks for being part of the Hazard Ground.
You bet.
You've been listening to the Hazard Ground Podcast, hosted by Mark Zeno and produced by Matt Pascarella. If you have an interesting story to tell and you'd like to be on the show, send us an email at hazardgroundpodcast@gmail.com. And if you like the show, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.